Hello and welcome. Speaking to Legends podcast. This show is a quest for ideas, insights, and stories from the lives of the most successful hedge fund managers. We learn about their spectacular careers, we share their life lessons, and dissect their investment techniques. The legend of today is Viktor Hagani. Viktor was one of the founding partners of Long Term Capital Management, one of the largest hedge funds at that time, and had an impressive career on Wall Street. In this episode, we discuss Viktor's early days at Salomon Brothers, launch of LTCM, and subsequent debacle. Viktor discusses lessons he learned from those experiences and how his investing style changed along the way. Let's get right into it. Hello, Viktor. I'm really excited to have you on this show. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Nikita. Good to be on it.
You started your career at Salomon Brothers. Can you please tell us about your years there and maybe some stories? And while answering that, maybe you could also touch upon the game called Liar's Poker, which was popularized by Michael Lewis' book, and the impact that it had on your evolution as a trader.
Sure. So I started at Salomon Brothers in 1984 after graduating from the London School of Economics. And I started to work in a group called the Bond Portfolio Analysis Group, which is a research group at Salomon Brothers that was doing sort of specific, it was distinct from another group that did macroeconomic research. We were more looking at the characteristics of bonds in terms of cash flows and, you know, a more quantitative look at sort of individual bonds and bond portfolios. Our group was, the group that I joined, my boss was Bob Koprasch, who was a terrific boss that really helped me develop and gave me a lot of responsibility and taught me a lot and had me join in all kinds of different things. And then after a couple of years, I was asked to move from that group to the trading floor to join the arbitrage group that had been established and was run by John Merriweather, the second of my bosses at Salomon, who was also as good a boss as one could ever hope for. And my colleagues there in the arbitrage group have all become lifelong friends. So it was I was really fortunate to join this this group. When you asked about Liar's Poker, Liar's Poker was a game that was played primarily out on the trading floor among traders, but the location of the games tended to be out on the trading floor. And I'm going to assume that your listeners know a little bit about the rules of Liar's Poker, you know, I think that the Liar's Poker taught us a lot of lessons about trying to control your emotions and make sort of the most rational decisions possible. And so there was always this tendency in the game to bid higher so as to avoid like a certain loss. So let me give you an example of what I mean. So let's say you're in a five-person game, and somebody bids 6/8. So he would win if everybody challenged his bid, and then you counted up all the eights, and there were at least 6/8 among the five players. So let's say that the bid comes to you, you're the second person after him, and you know you think that he has at least 2 or maybe even 3/8. You know, he's bidding these 6/8 in his ultimate bid. And you're sitting there with 2/8, and you say to yourself, geez, if I challenge this, he's going to count it and probably he's going to win, because if I have 2 and he has 2 or 3, then he only needs 1 or 2 from the other 3 players and he's likely to win. And let's say somebody else had even bid 8s at a lower level. So you suspect that you're going to, you're highly confident that you're going to lose if you challenge. So let's say you have an 80% chance of losing if you challenge. But if you go up to 7/8, you know, you actually think that you have a that maybe you have a 30% chance of winning and a 70% chance of losing. Well, the thing is that if you challenge and you lose, you just lose $1. Let's say the stakes of the game are $1. You just lose $1 because the winner wins $1 from everybody in that case. But in the other case, if you lose, you have to pay $1 to the other four people. And if you win, you win $1 from the other four people. And so, you know, like if you just have a 30% chance of winning by going up, right, then you have a 30% chance of winning $4, that's $1.20, but you have a 70% chance of losing $4, that's $2.80, right? And so your expected loss is $1.60 versus just challenging and losing almost for sure the $1. And, you know, there's just this human tendency to throw good money after bad money, to not want to take a loss. And, you know, this would be an example where taking the loss and challenging, and there's also, not only do you lose the money, but everybody yells at you. They say, why did you challenge if you had two? You're such a wimp and all of that. But you would have to sort of get over all of that and just play, you know, the most rational way possible. And there was a lot of that in the game. You know, I think it taught us a lot. And even beyond everything that it taught us about trying to be disciplined and rational about things, there was also a great camaraderie to the game. It was so much fun. It was a way, it was something that really brought people together. You know, I think Liar's Poker was was something that was great. You know, maybe it was a manifestation of something that was great already.
Certainly sounds like the game was a lot of fun, and it taught you a lesson or two about risk management, thinking probabilities, and controlling your emotions. Because I can imagine that it's quite similar to poker, where you need to really look at the surroundings and understand the psychology, but also kind of govern your thinking mostly by probabilities. And I would like to kind of build up on your journey at Salomon. So you, together with your colleagues, you went on to launch long-term capital management, and this was on the back of having several years when your team was responsible for over 100% of global profits of Salomon. So how did this transition happen, and what was it like to be part of the largest hedge fund launch at that time?
Well, it was it all happened very, very quickly, and we were busy setting things up. I mean, I guess the you know, in some ways, perhaps we underestimated the difficulties of trying to recreate the infrastructure and the environment that we had at Salomon Brothers in creating the hedge fund. We needed to go out and set up all new relationships with counterparties. And of course, you know, at Salomon Brothers, had customers that would help to finance positions or lend bonds and so on, which we had to, which we became one step removed from once we set up LTCM, and then needed to use all the different banks to help us do the same sorts of activities. Yeah, I guess it just felt like the time was right in terms of the evolution that was going on at Salomon Brothers and the opportunity to do this. So, you know, I guess over the course of 6 or 9 months, you know, a number of us left Salomon Brothers to join John Merriweather and set things up. So, I don't know. I hope that's sort of responsive to the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And what were the first few years like, and what was the general strategy of the fund?
Well, the strategy was really what we were doing at Salomon Brothers prior to that, which was relative value trades. So the idea was to try to identify longs and shorts that we felt were going to converge in value to each other. So it was very much a value-oriented starting point for the trades that we would do. Of course, we would try to do a lot of analysis in terms of what was the cause of this perceived misvaluation of two similar or near identical instruments being priced at different in different ways? What would be the frictions involved in putting on the trade and in holding the trade? And what would be the catalysts that would bring about some convergence of value rather than, you know, a continued divergence of value? So, you know, we were primarily doing things within the fixed income market. You know, we would trade in on the run versus off the run bonds, and we would trade in different parts of the volatility structure of interest rates, doing trades along the swap curve or between the swap and bond curve. And, you know, generally we would try to link, you know, that if we could find trades that we could link together to get a greater efficiency, we would do that. So, you know, if one trade was, you know, long A and short B, and then there was another trade that we could do, which would be long B and short C, then to be able to just do long A and short C would kind of be more efficient than if you were looking at either of those two trades, A versus B and B versus C, independently. So, you know, and then we, you know, at Salomon, you know, we were kind of slowly moving into, you know, other kinds of relative value trades. So, you know, at Salomon, we had been doing mortgage-backed relative value trades and, you know, making trades that were based on views on prepayments of U.S. mortgages or just, you know, the cheapness and spreads and the rolls and so on. And from mortgages, we looked at some capital structure trades, convertible bond trades, warrant trades. And, you know, little by little, we started to do more in different kinds of special situation equity things as well. And so, you know, over time, we branched out across products, but, you know, generally, we were always looking at things that where there was some identifiable amount of relative value that we thought we could extract over time.
On the back of these strategies and increased sophistication in models and the complexity of the counterparts that you were working with, you printed a very strong performance in the first few years. What happened then? And at what point did you realize that things are getting out of control?
Well, we started right at the beginning of 94, maybe February of 94. And, you know, I would say in some ways things never went the way that we thought that they would. You know, in 94, 95, 96, everything that we did seemed to be converging much faster than we ever had witnessed in our years at Salomon Brothers. And you know, that we were very focused on trying to understand what was happening. So really right from the beginning, we kind of had signals that things were different, that markets were behaving differently than they did when we were at Salomon Brothers. In the beginning, we were making a lot more money than we thought, than we expected by a lot. You know, we had years that were where we were making a 50% return on capital, which just was so much higher than we thought was possible. And, you know, as this was happening, the opportunity set was also getting to be less and less attractive overall. I mean, new things would crop up, but there was just a lot of convergence, and it felt like the market was moving towards overall greater efficiency. In late 97, really the spring of 1998, we started to see things move in the opposite direction, and also with a degree of autocorrelation and correlation among the trades, and also just, you know, the number of days in a row that we would lose money kind of being really quite surprising as well. So in 1998, we started to cut positions. We knew that that the former Salomon Brothers arbitrage area was reducing their positions from direct from the direction of the management of Citigroup at the time, where that had become a division of Citi. And you know, and maybe this was something that was kind of triggering the move in that direction. And then you know, events later in 1998, you know, particularly the Russian default on domestic debt, you know, and other things kind of triggered a flight to quality. And you know, we eventually became the focus of the marketplace. And you know, and the rest of it is well covered in a number of books, you know, in terms of the loss of our capital. I mean, one of the things that we did at the end of 1997 was that we reduced the size of the fund, and we also, and also the partners of LTCM, myself included, we became a much bigger percentage of the ownership of the fund itself, which we'll talk about in a minute. So yeah, I think that's, you know, I think the events that led up to the loss, the large losses at LTCM and 90% losses of capital in 1998 are pretty well covered and do a reasonable job of describing those market events.
As you look back on that experience, what are the main lessons that you've learned?
So I guess the biggest lesson that I think LTCM offers to people looking back on it is not really the one that comes out to my mind, you know, having read, I guess I've read probably all of the most of the books that have come out that have talked about LTCM, but there is a pretty pretty large amount of literature. You know, looking back on it, I think that the decisions that are that get the least attention from observers are the decisions that the partners of LTCM made individually about how much of their savings they would have invested in the fund. And so, you know, when you're investing, you know, you can always make bad investments. You know, I think that the investments that we chose to put into the fund, they were good investments. And in fact, you know, a few years, by and large, a few years after the collapse of LTCM, most of the trades that we had had on prior to 1998 worked out okay. So, you know, that if we had, you know, it wasn't that we even chose such bad trade, you know, we didn't choose trades that in the end turned out to be bad trades. We chose trades that, you know, altogether lost a lot more money than we thought they would lose over a period of time. And that can happen to any trades that that an investor chooses. And if you're using leverage, the probability of losing 100% is magnified versus, you know, if you're doing a long only sort of investment strategy. So I think that the lessons around the investing that we did for the fund are interesting, but they're not so useful to other people. I think people kind of recognize that, you know, if you invest, you're taking risk, you can lose money. And if you're using leverage, you can lose all your money. So that's pretty clear, and it's important to know. But I think what's more interesting in the story of LTCM is that by and large, the partners invested quite a lot of their own personal savings into the fund. And, you know, it certainly seemed like a good thing to be doing. I mean, we had investors from the outside that were begging to invest in our fund and were happy to pay the fees that we were charging, which were high fees. In fact, they were even willing to pay higher fees or a premium to invest. And now, here we were having access to invest in our own fund without paying those high fees. You know, even if we charged ourselves some fees, we weren't going to charge ourselves the full fees. And the returns had been good. It was something that we understood very well. And so it was natural to feel like that we should invest a lot of our own savings into the fund. Well, it really brings up this whole question of how do you ever decide how much to invest in an attractive investment opportunity that has risk? And and I think that really brings me to what's become interesting to me over the last 20 years or so, which is that the sizing of investments, is a really critical decision that deserves more attention from investors, especially from individual investors thinking about their own savings. In the years at Salomon Brothers, and at the beginning of LTCM, the sizing of the trades that we were doing would often be determined by outside constraints, such as, how much capital or how much balance sheet we were able to use, or there would be constraints from above that would limit the size of the attractive thing, the things that we were doing that we thought were attractive, without having to get into a more fundamental sizing sort of decision. And so, I think that the lesson is that individuals need to really focus on the sizing of their investments. When they find attractive investments, the answer to the question of how big to be is not to figure out what maximizes your expected value, but rather what maximizes your risk-adjusted value, or stated another way, your expected utility. And I think that if somebody sits down and tries to think through the decision that we faced as partners at LTCM, let's say, like in my case, I don't remember the exact numbers, but let's say that I decided to ultimately invest 80% of my savings, of my liquid savings, in the fund, and let's say I had 20% that I didn't have invested in the fund. And I've talked to people today that run hedge funds who have 80% invested in their fund, and who kind of feel that they're being relatively prudent. Is it prudent to have 80% of your money invested in your fund and 20% not? Well, it might seem that way to begin with, until you also realize that not only do you have 80% of your liquid net worth invested in your fund, but you also have an ownership. If you're a partner, you're going to have an ownership of the management company as well. And if you value that, all of a sudden, it looks like the 20% of your savings that you don't have in your fund is really more like 10% or less of your money that you don't have in your fund. The value of the value of your holding of the management company can be easily worth as much as your savings at that time, depending on where you are in your career. I mean, it differs for each person. I mean, for instance, at this point in time, if we look at RenTech, right, and the Medallion Fund and so on, now the fund investments for the partners of RenTech, or the senior partners of RenTech, is the Medallion Fund is a relatively small holding because they've made so much money by this point. But earlier on in their journey, they owned the management company, and they also had 100% or close to 100% of their money invested in their fund, until they made so much money that they sort of grew out of that. And I think that any sort of expected utility analysis that one does, where you recognize that there's a 1 in 100 or even a 1 in 1,000 chance that there's a failure of your hedge fund, of that investment, would lead you to have a lot less of your liquid financial capital invested in your fund. So I think that using something more of a expected utility framework, would have led the partners of LTCM to probably have had 50% or less of their liquid net worth invested in our fund. And that actually would have led us to different decisions also, probably about whether we would have returned investor capital, whether we wanted to keep the fund small and get a high return, or have a much larger fund and sort of have a lower return on a much larger fund that also would have had less probability of a catastrophic loss. And in reading the experience of other investors, you know, over the the last 22 years since LTCM, you know, I don't think that these observations have really been taken up by other people that are in that same position. I mean, I still read about hedge funds and entrepreneurs that just decide to go all in on their business because they're so bullish on it, and don't really seem to be taking into account a small probability of a very large negative utility outcome. Look, each person has their own sort of personal utility function, but I think in general, I think that's a good, valuable lesson from LTCM that hasn't been talked about enough.
It certainly is a great insight and a valuable lesson about the simple equation of the hedge funds, where there are essentially two models for a fund to maximize the economics. One is where the strategy is driven by constraint, capacity constraint, and so you try to maximize the return. And once you generated enough profit, then you try to crowd out your investors and get the fund to be comprised only of the inside capital. And the reverse of this is where you try to get as much AUM as possible, and you are happy to accept a lower rate of return, and where you essentially bet in on the management fees. Obviously, these two approaches are fundamentally different, but you seem to imply that this needs to be very well thought through, and one is, by its nature, is much more risky than the other. And this, all of this calculation should be based on the utility function. I believe that after LTCM experience, you took some time off, but then after some years, you founded another investment firm that is preaching some of this realization that you picked up along your career journey. So what are these principles, and what was this investment firm built on?
Sure. So after LTCM, I stayed on at LTCM to help to liquidate the portfolio, for which took about a year or so. And then I stayed on at a successor fund that took some of the remaining LTCM positions and also raised capital from some of LTCM's prior investors and some new investors. And we started a new fund called JWM Partners, named after John Merriweather. That hedge fund, I guess, had a longer life than LTCM did as well, in fact. But I left in 2001, I guess. And then I was really sort of on a sabbatical for a while, where I was just looking at different things and spending time with the family, learning to fly a plane, sort of crossing various things off my lifetime bucket list, getting up to Alaska to go fly fishing for salmon, and just spending a lot of time with my family, doing a lot of reading. And for the first time in my entire career, really amazingly, I started to really think about a sensible way of investing my family's savings that had been the residual savings that I had after LTCM. And it's really remarkable to think that there I was. I was 40 years old, and I had never really thought that much about how to invest my own savings, other than, for the years from 94 until 99 or whatever, where I just had such a large investment in LTCM itself. And, I guess I followed the path of a lot of financial professionals, where the first thing that I did when I started to really focus on my family savings was I tried to find various special alpha generating great investments. So I started to invest in hedge funds and private equity and angel deals and all sorts of different things, feeling that I was kind of a financial expert, and even if I didn't want to be running an investment fund myself, at least I could identify other smart people that could generate really good returns. And over the course of a few years, I started to become really disenchanted with that. I realized that it was an almost impossible task for me on a somewhat part-time basis to identify active managers that would sort of beat the market and deliver good returns. And you know, there are the fees that they have to overcome. And for a US person like myself, you know, that generally special investments, alternative investments tend to have very onerous taxation in the US tax code. And so I guess I just started to feel like I needed to get back to a more simple and basic way of investing. And I got attracted to just saying, well, I want as much diversification as possible. I want no leverage. I want to be long only. I never want to be forced to sell anything. And so I kind of gravitated towards, well, I'm just going to start to invest passively. You know, maybe I'll have 70% in global equities, 30% in bonds, and that will be that. You know, I'll leave it that way. And that will be my family's investment approach going forward. It will be tax efficient, cost efficient. It'll have great, you know, a lot of great characteristics. And as I was moving in that direction, I guess I kind of realized a couple of things. You know, one was, I guess the first thing was that I just realized that I was unlikely to stick with such a static strategy in the long term. You know, that I could just imagine that I would, you know, that I would say, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is what I'll do with my family's savings. And then 5 years later, there'd be some changes in market pricing of different things. And I would say, oh, maybe I should really be 80% in equities, or maybe I should be 55% in equities. And so, you know, I kind of believed that over time, the expected return of equities and the expected return of fixed income changes in ways that are identifiable. They're not changing in ways that are predictable, but that the expected return changes, and that people kind of agree that the expected return at one point is higher than another point. I mean, when equities are trading with a cape of 15, you know, most people would say that the expected return of equities is higher with a cape of 15 than when the cape is 30. And I kind of felt like, well, if that's the case, do I really want to have the same amount of equities when cape is 15 as when cape is 30? And I was like, no, I think I'd like to have more equities when cape is 15 than when cape is 30. So I realized that I wanted to have something that was sort of eyes open and somewhat responsive to what was happening in the world, and that would also make me stick with the strategy in a more disciplined and long-term way. So, you know, I like the idea of passive investing, but I felt that it needed a little bit of an overlay for valuation or expected returns, where the asset allocation would change in line with some very simple metrics of expected return for different equity markets, regional equity markets, and fixed income markets. And so I started to do that I formulated that. I did some research. I got a paper. I wrote a paper on it, which with a co-researcher, Rich Dewey, which eventually got published in the Journal of Portfolio Management, which was just a look back at this type of investing. You know, as I was doing this and moving my family's investment in this way, a number of my friends said that they were attracted to it as well. And if I set up a firm to actually do this, that they would like to invest in that way as well. And that became that led to the birth of Elm Partners, a firm I set up at the end of 2011 and early 2012. And basically at Elm Partners, we manage investment portfolios for individuals. Mostly it's for financial professionals. Basically, help them to invest in a portfolio of ETFs and index funds, where we try to manage it for them over time, moving more into more into equity markets that have higher returns or less when they have lower expected returns. We also do tax loss harvesting. My, that's become my lifetime project, which I've been, as I say, working on for about the last 10 years. And, it's kind of tied up with a lot of desire to share the lessons that I've learned over my life of investing and the mistakes that I've made. And, trying to get people to think more about, especially financial professionals who are sophisticated enough where they kind of get these things, but their day-to-day job is trying to, is like deeply immersed in the financial markets, trying to deliver alpha for themselves or for their clients, trying to find, good deals, raising money for clients, whatever. And, they have a great familiarity with financial markets. And, I think that for their personal savings, it makes a lot of sense to take a more passive, beta-like approach to investing and sort of leave the alpha generation for their day job. So that's Elm Partners and its foundation and kind of what we do.
It's clear that Elm Partners and LTCM were built on a completely opposite set of principles, all while Elm being a utility maximization driven approach, which is endorsing the simplicity and trying to pick up the low-hanging fruits, while LTCM was more of a bet on trying to outsmart everyone and trying to deliver the highest returns. In your research, you introduced the idea of expectation-driven sizing. What does it mean, and why do you think it is superior to simple market cap weighted index investing?
An expectation-driven sizing means trying to set up your portfolio that in a way that reflects long-term expected returns, which, as I say, I think most people do feel are relatively predictable. The portfolio is still based upon broad market, market cap weighted index funds. And what we're doing is we're just deciding how much US exposure to have, not really going away from the market cap indexes, but saying how much US equity exposure should we have? How much European equity exposure? How much EM exposure? And I think that there really are two benefits of sizing your positions according to what you think are long-term expected returns. One of them is that it should deliver a higher risk-adjusted return for investors to invest in that way. Having a higher exposure when returns are higher and a lower exposure when returns are lower will generally result in a better long-term risk-adjusted return. But the other thing is that I feel that it's really hard to stick with a static asset allocation over time in a disciplined fashion. And so by incorporating a certain amount of a dynamic asset allocation into the process, that it also makes the investment approach something that's easier to stick with over the long term, because you won't sort of just subjectively decide one day after reading the newspaper, the world is terrible, I need to reduce my equity exposure. That it's very hard for people to do that in a way that improves expected long-term risk-adjusted returns, because it's all becomes very subjective. It's like, even if you somebody in early March, the market was falling apart in early March, and they said, things are terrible, we're in for a depression, I'm going to reduce my equity exposure. They reduce their equity exposure, the market continues to go down. They say to themselves, I'm so glad that I did that. That was really good that I did that. And the market goes down. They look at they look at things, and the market is 20% lower than where they sold. But what's their disciplined way of getting back into the market? So they've reduced and they're feeling good about it. But do they really have a plan for when they're going to get back in? And when the market goes down afterwards, they kind of feel vindicated and reinforced in their view that we're going into this depression. And, you know, it might only be 2 or 3 years later that they finally get forced into buying again after the market is now, 35% higher than when they sold in the beginning of March 2020. So it's just very, very difficult to get both the selling and the buying right when you're doing kind of newspaper-driven, subjective market timing, versus trying to do it in a very rules-based, disciplined fashion, which is what we've tried to embody, at Elm Partners. And we use two signals for expected return. One of them is effectively the earnings yield, or 1/CAPE for equities, so a long-term valuation-based metric. And the other one is a momentum metric, where value and momentum put together in that way, feels like a good combination. It kind of helps to momentum switch to negative, for instance, at the end of February. So that's kind of your things are bad, I'm going to reduce. And when value and momentum are pointing in the same direction, it tends to, those rare moments tend to be ones where returns are, quite high when value and momentum are pointing up, and it tends to be a good time to reduce investments when value and momentum are both pointing downwards. The other thing I should mention about what we're doing at Elm Partners is, I talked about diversification and efficiency, cost efficiency, tax efficiency. We felt it was really important to be fully transparent and to have really low fees. So everything that we do is, there's no black box. Everything we do is fully available for investors to understand. We want investors to embrace what we're doing and to feel that we're just implementing what they would want to be doing themselves if they had the time to do it. And we also charge really low fees. We charge 12 basis point fees. That's it. There's no incentive fee or other fees. So kind of low fees, risk diversification, risk efficiency, cost efficiency, tax efficiency. We think those are the low hanging fruits for investing, which all investors should try to capture for their personal investing.
This makes lots of sense. So like trying to kind of converge from two ways on one side, as you were discussing, the behavioral biases that lead people to be greedy when they should be fearful, and vice versa. And then on the other hand, obviously trying to be to maximize the efficiency through the taxes and all of the benefits and the cost, which is perhaps the most fundamental one. And as a part of Elm, you publish a lot of experimental research. And one of the ones that I got particularly interested in was about coin flipping betting games, where I guess you further proved the behavioral biases that are present in people's decision making. Can you please give some background on this experiment, and what were your main takeaways?
Right. Well, it was an experiment where we were trying to understand how, how people approached the question of sizing of bets. And so we went out and the subjects, the participants in our experiment were all highly quantitatively trained, generally financially trained, younger people. A lot of them were in university at the time, and also a number of them were young professionals in the finance field too. And so we set up an experiment. We set up a game where we got 20 people together at a time, and we told them, we're going to let you play this game where you can flip a coin on a computer, on the computer. You can flip a coin. The coin has a 60% chance of landing heads and a 40% chance of landing on tails. We're going to give you, I think, $50. Each one of you gets $50 to start with. And you can bet any amount that you want on this coin flip. And you can bet, you know, we're going to give you, I don't know, I think it was 20 minutes we gave them to play the game, which would allow them to make up to 200 or 300 flips. And and you can bet as much as you want on each flip. And at the end of the time, however much money you have made, however much money you have in your sort of bank account here, we're going to pay you that with a check or cash. Up to a certain limit. You know, we're not going to pay you $1 million, you know, but, and if you get close to the limit in terms of how much we're going to pay you, we'll tell you so that you know that you're close to the limit, so that we won't have you making bets that would take you above the limit, even though we wouldn't pay you that. And so, and the limit that we set, which we didn't tell them about until they got close to it, I think was about $250. And, so, you know, maybe the listeners want to think a little bit about, you know, how they would approach the game. But what we found from the participants that in this game were that, I don't know, I think about 20% of the players actually wound up losing all of their, all of the money that we gave them. Another 20 or 30% broke even, and only 20% of the players reached the maximum value of $250 when sort of the game would stop for them. And, you know, people just were betting in very, you know, basically people just in general did not have a systematic approach to betting, where, you know, once you stand back and think about what's the right way to put the bets down, you know, it becomes very intuitive and clear. And, you know, that by following a sensible betting strategy, you know, we show that the player should have had a 97%, you know, that each player has like a 97% chance of reaching the $250. So, you know, it was really quite remarkable. And it really reinforced our feeling that the sizing of investments is something that doesn't get enough coverage in financial education, whether it be at universities or in the financial press. You know, that we feel that that investing involves two tasks. One of them is deciding what's a good investment. You know, what's going to go up, what's going to go down, figuring out what are the things that you want to invest in. But then the second part is how big you should be in those. And if you get the first one right, but the second decision wrong, you can lose all your money. Whereas if you get the first decision wrong and the second one right, you'll lose money, but you won't lose all of your money. So I would say that the second decision is perhaps the more critical, but gets a lot less attention than the first one about what are the good investments. So so that's really become like a central theme. My partner in Elm, James White, and I are trying to write a book that really tries to dig into this whole topic. And, you know, we think it's really important in terms of personal investing and professional investing too.
Yeah, as you put it, it makes it a rather obvious conclusion. The importance of bet sizing is it's a critical component of a longer term sustainability of investment strategy and in general, kind of ensuring the longevity. We'll always conclude our episodes by asking our guests, what are the three pieces of advice would you give to your younger self?
Well, I guess the first one has to be following in this theme that we've talked about throughout this podcast of, you know, when it comes to the really big, important questions in life, decisions in life, you know, whether they be financial or other, that that making the decisions based upon expected utility rather than expected value will really lead you to the better decisions over time. So I'm not saying that, you know, every decision that you have in life to try to be very analytical about it, but for the big ones, you know, for how to invest your savings or career choices and so on, that thinking about expected utility rather than expected value is really important, which really means recognizing that that bad outcomes are have a much bigger is a much bigger delta sort of on your utility than the good outcomes are. So, you know, try to make decisions where very bad downsides, like going bankrupt or being out of work or whatever, that those things should have a much bigger weight in your decision-making process. So using expected utility rather than expected value, I think, is the first lesson. The second one I would say is that in guiding your life, you have to try to find some sort of balance between grit and perseverance on the one hand, which is very important. You've got to stick with things. You've got to get through things that you commit to. But you also have to have sort of a stop loss mentality in mind as well. You know, that you can't just, you know, that if failure is not an option, if you approach things where you say failure is not an option, that works. But sometimes when failure is inevitable, then the failure becomes really, really big. So you've got to have some sort of stop loss in mind as well, that you've got to be willing to quit at some point, and probably making that be in some sort of predetermined promise to yourself. So I think finding the balance between grit and quitting or stop loss is the second thing that I think I wish I had thought more about as a younger person. And the third thing is probably the best piece of advice I can give to anybody, is to get a dog. If you can have a dog, if you have a place to have a dog, get yourself a dog. It really makes your life so much richer. If not a dog, maybe a cat. But having a pet is just a wonderful enhancement to life that I think many people can do.
Seems like Chief Happiness Officer at Alm is playing an important role.
He's sitting here next to me right now as we speak.
Victor has his dog listed as a Chief Happiness Officer on Alm website. Okay, Victor, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Speak soon.
Thanks, Nikita. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Speaking to Legends. I hope you found it to be useful and thought-provoking. If you enjoyed this show, please write a review on iTunes to support us. Stay tuned.